We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Well, good morning. It is Friday, March 8th, and President Biden began his State of the Union last night by talking about Ukraine. Not even America. You can see where his priorities were so clearly. And even though his chief of staff said that you'll see a very enthusiastic president, I think that he was more a very, very angry president. He pounded his fist on the table a few times. He seemed very angry and just really didn't have a good positive view of any, even though, of course, he said the state of our union is strong and getting stronger than ever. He really didn't back that up with any facts, of course, and there were definitely a number of blatant lies. He tried to start out with a little bit of levity that said his first words were, if I were smart, I would just go home now. And yet he spoke for about an hour and 20 minutes-ish after being about 15 minutes late. So everything didn't kick off until about 9:17 or 18 p.m. Eastern last night. And this was his longest State of the Union in his four-year history, and hopefully his last State of the Union address. But it was really interesting because, of course, he started out with Ukraine and talked about everything going on in Ukraine rather than America. And he didn't address the border until over 50 minutes in his speech. And, of course, he laid the blame for that at the hands of Congress and said that if Congress would get together a border bill, he would sign it. Of course, the GOP response was, we've been trying here. It's not really our fault. It's the fault of Democrats collectively. And, of course, their leader currently is Joe Biden. But within the first 5 minutes, he also addressed January 6th and, of course, did speak about President Donald Trump, but not by name, just called him my predecessor or, you know, the former president. And, you know, he just continued to talk about MAGA extremism, and it was very, very divisive. This was not a message that left anybody. I think even those who stood up and applauded and, you know, he's their representative. I don't think anybody rationally or reasonably could have come away from last night thinking that was such a positive message, and isn't the state of our union really strong, and I'm so proud to have a leader like Joe Biden who stood up and said all of that. And he also, in one really just historically fascinating moment to me, having watched quite a few of these, he of course, you know, he's giving his address to Congress, and historically, justices of the U.S. Supreme Court do attend, even though regardless of whether it's a Democrat or Republican president, because they are the non-political branch, they don't applaud, they don't stand up, they don't make any you know, gestures. They're just there out of respect, I guess, for the president. But Justice Alito has not attended in recent years since President Obama condemned and criticized the majority opinion in Citizens United during his presidency. And Alito, I think, rightly said that that was inappropriate in front of the justices, and it was also inappropriate for a State of the Union address. And so he hasn't attended since. And I did not see Justice Clarence Thomas or Amy Coney Barrett in attendance, but Roberts, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Sotomayor, Kagan, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh were all there. And Biden took the opportunity to demand codification of Roe versus Wade and actually addressed the judges by looking at them, the justices, looked at them and basically threatened them. I mean, it was remarkably disrespectful. And I think we have a clip on this one. Let's see. So this would be cut six, I think. Let's play that one.
Decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court majority wrote the following. And with all due respect, justices, women are not without electoral power. Electoral or political power. You're about to realize just how much you get right about that. Clearly. Clearly.
So disrespectful. I mean, saying, justices, you're wrong about that, and you're about to recognize that. I mean, it was overtly threatening, very disrespectful. And I would not be surprised if some of the justices under Chief Justice Roberts debated this and deliberated it and determined that perhaps it's not appropriate for Supreme Court justices to attend a future State of the Union addresses, regardless, again, of what political party the president is a part of. It's ridiculously inappropriate. And a lot of the response as well on social media and from different pundits and others, including, for example, former Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, said this was a campaign speech. It wasn't the State of the Union address. And coming 2 days off of the heels of Super Tuesday, that's what we anticipated, but not quite as overtly. The president should never use that opportunity to be as blatantly campaign driven as he clearly was. He should set priorities for his agenda, focus on the administration, not focus on his political opposition, which is really what he did. And he also said, this was his comment about, I'm ready to fix the border, completely not taking responsibility or even addressing the 350,000 illegal immigrants that his administration has admitted to flying across the border. So this is cut three.
Look, folks, we have a simple choice. We can fight about fixing the border or we can fix it. I'm ready to fix it.
Yeah. Well, actions speak louder than words, Mr. President, and clearly he's not ready to fix anything. That the Democrats' entire agenda is to have open borders and to bring illegals across the border so that not only can crime rise in America and we can deteriorate and be a nation in decline, but they are, of course, trying to make new voters. That has been their agenda for a while. And Biden did not address by name, of course, Laken Riley, who was the young student from the University of Georgia that was murdered in cold blood. And Marjorie Taylor Greene started shouting and demanding, say her name, say her name. And Biden eventually said Lincoln Riley. And then, of course, like he always does, said that he empathized with her parents and her family because he also has lost a son. I mean, Biden always makes it totally about himself as if everything revolves around his own experience and he can understand that just because of losing a child himself. I mean, it was so flippant. It was so disrespectful. This is cut one.
Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right. But how many of the thousands of people being killed by illegals? To her parents, I say, my heart goes out to you, having lost children myself. I understand. But look, if we change the dynamic at the border, people pay these small.
Yeah, but I it's horrible, but I mean, that's always so disrespectful. And the whole tenor of the entire thing was disrespectful. And yet, you know, Democrats, of course, were on their feet. They were cheering. The GOP contingent was not quite as as much of hecklers as they were last year. And according to reports, Speaker Johnson had talked to the conference ahead of time and asked them to be more respectful. Speaker Johnson's facial expressions were part of were one of my favorite thing last night. I think that he was all of us. He almost had that kind of Tucker Carlson confused look on his face, like, what is Biden even saying? Because this is so antithetical to reality. It was like Biden was trying to just project what he wished the State of the Union would be, or what he wanted people to think that it was, but it was so clearly in contrast to what is actually going on. And so I anchored on the coverage on Salem News Channel last night, and Representative Jim Jordan joined after the fact to talk about some of the response. And this is what he had to say on where the GOP goes from here. We talked about substantively some of that, and I don't have time to play as many clips as I wish I did. We have, you know, a solid 14 of them that I can pick from today. But you can always go back and watch that full segment. But I asked him, okay, so here's the blatant disrespect that Biden has for the country. Where does the GOP go from here? This is Cut 12.
We just keep doing our job. We have a constitutional duty to do oversight of the executive branch. That includes the impeachment inquiry that was launched by the previous speaker back in the fall of last year. We need to continue to do that work. Next week, we're having Robert Hur, the special counsel, who gave us his report and said Joe Biden deliberately, intentionally mishandled classified information, and then deliberately and intentionally gave that classified information to the ghostwriter of his book. Special counsel Hur said that because he's a forgetful old man who's going to come across in a sympathetic way to juries, I'm not going to charge him with the crime. So we got him testifying. We have other witnesses we need to talk to that the Justice Department is keeping from us. We may have to go to court on that, but we're going to do our duty, and then we'll make a decision as a conference if, in fact, we move forward with actual articles.
So that was Representative Jim Jordan in response to the State of the Union last night. And of course, the GOP, like the opposition party always does, they select someone to give the official response that is also aired. And that was given by Senator Katie Britt. Of course, we talked yesterday about Representative De La Cruz from Texas, who gave the Spanish version, which I don't speak Spanish, but I read the transcript. My opinion was that she did a lot better than Katie Britt. There is a sharp divide over the response to Katie Britt, because she was sitting in a kitchen. I don't know if it was hers or it was a set. Just wearing some casual clothes and speaking primarily, it seemed, to suburban moms. In my opinion, it was very overacted. It was overdramatic. The visual was good, that she was such a contrast between, you know, the old dementia patient that is Biden, the guy in cognitive decline, just like our country is in decline. And the visual was great. She could have been so solid, just like Sarah Sanders. Governor Sarah Sanders last year was incredibly solid. But Sarah Sanders is very ready for prime time. She understands, having been a former press secretary, what it takes to do these kinds of speeches. Senator Katie Britt appeared to be a little nervous. She is the youngest Republican senator ever elected to the U.S. Senate. She has two young kids. I mean, in terms of who she is and what she brings to the table, it would have been great. But it came across a little bit desperate tradwife, in my opinion. And I posted this survey on social media last night, and it's gotten 1,096 votes so far. And literally, the response right down the middle, I asked, okay, Katie Britt response, is this cringy tradwife vibe or genuine suburban mom vibe? The cringy, 51%. Genuine was 49%. So there was a divide. And if she was just speaking to a demographic that the GOP needs for Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee and the likely nominee to win in November, then she did her job. But for the rest of a lot of commentators, including my friend Charlie Kirk, a number of others, Alan West, who I had on last night, everybody is predicting that her response is going to be the SNL soft open this Saturday night. I would not be surprised. So we'll be right back with more analysis and breakdown of the State of the Union and the GOP response when we come right back here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. When Charlotte found out she was pregnant, she was 7 weeks along. In the back of her mind, she thought abortion was the best solution. But after hearing her baby's heartbeat and seeing her beautiful baby on an ultrasound, she chose life. Her heart is filled with gratitude for all of you who made this possible. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and the death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles the baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I've been delivering real results in fiscally responsible ways. We've already cut the federal deficit. We've already cut the federal deficit over $1 trillion.
Joe Biden and the 2024 State of the Union was last night, and hopefully it will be his last State of the Union address. So we're continuing to break down all of the very interesting moments, and I would say outright lies that Biden continued to peddle, and also the GOP response from Katie Britt. So joining me now to discuss is our very good friend Dinesh D'Souza, who is the host of the Dinesh D'Souza Show on the Salem Podcast Network, and whose son-in-law just won his congressional district outright in Texas on March 5th. So, Dinesh, congratulations to Brandon Gill. That was amazing that he didn't even have to go to a runoff. So, first, before we get into the response to the State of the Union, congratulations on that, and how is your family feeling?
Well, thank you. We're exhilarated by it, and we had hoped that he could cross over 50%, which would be a feat in itself because there were 11 candidates in the race. It was an open seat. And at the last minute, a kind of a coalition of Never Trump super PACs dropped in a massive $2 million ad spend against Brandon. So he was facing some pretty formidable odds, but he had a really good campaign, and he came out with 58%. The next person in line was at about 18%. So that was a remarkable sweep of this congressional district. And so we're thrilled. It's a very pro-red, pro-Trump district, so he should have a fairly easy time winning in November. And we're going to have a congressman in the family.
That's so fantastic. Well, congratulations. And I was very excited to see the results of the Texas primaries. Our good friend Katrina Pearson is one who's running out of House District 33 on the state level and is going to the runoff. And she was on with me last week saying that there are 22 contested races to try to get out some of those Republicans in name only, the Democrat lights that have not been advancing a conservative agenda. So hopefully Texas is returning to conservative values rather than being more purple, as some of us have been really concerned about. So we'll look forward to that with interest, be praying for Brandon and his race. And let's talk about the State of the Union, Dinesh. What was your response overall to Biden? I just thought he was angry.
Very bitter, angry, partisan speech. The State of the Union isn't supposed to be that. It's not a campaign speech. And yet, Biden was raging against the right, and even if you look at the media coverage of the speech, they were kind of focusing on the applause on the Democratic side. But if you panned over to the Republican side, the reaction was completely different. And so Biden, while claiming to be trying to heal polarization, bring the country together, is obviously doing the exact opposite.
He is. And to say that the state of our union is strong and getting stronger, and his comments on having such a strong economy and he wants to solve the crisis on the border, and that he's, you know, he's advancing all of this legislation that's so in keeping with the Constitution. He even mentioned teaching the Second Amendment for 12 years, which I don't think was accurate at all. But it just it seemed to be a complete and total fiction. And what he prefers for Americans to think that just didn't line up with reality at all.
Yeah, this is where we are in politics, you know, and I miss the old politics where it was anchored in competing claims over facts, and people could disagree. But if you're watching, you could at least see where the ground of disagreement was. The problem now is that this rhetoric exists in a bubble. And if you compare it to what's going on in your own life, you're like, I don't see that. It makes absolutely no sense. And yet it's almost like they want you to believe the rhetoric over your actual experience. Now, whether they can con people into doing that, it seems to me to be a pretty tall order to get away with that. It's kind of like saying, you know, you're living in a neighborhood, you're terrified, there are serial killers running around, crime rates are epidemic, and yet some guy tells you that you're having an illusion. You're actually extremely safe. You don't even really have to lock your door. So who do you believe? Do you believe the rhetoric or do you believe the actual experiences around you? I think if people go with their experience, they'll realize that what we're getting is an unprecedented degree of just outright lying, not just from Biden, but also from a supportive media.
That is so true. And I'm speaking with Dinesh D'Souza, who, of course, is the host of the Dinesh D'Souza Show on the Salem Media Group. And the media is a huge factor here because they have taken Biden's rhetoric and they continue to run with that. And we've seen how much they have outright lied as well about the effects of the overturn of Roe versus Wade, which Biden promised to restore Roe last night. And I thought it was so inappropriate that he spoke directly to the justices of the United States Supreme Court that were sitting there and almost threatened them. And yet the mainstream media is suggesting that now, you know, there are women on the streets who just can't get health care because of the overturn of Roe versus Wade. And now IVF is illegal in Alabama because of the Supreme Court ruling saying that you have to handle with due care fertilized embryos. I mean, this rhetoric is so completely detached from reality. But the mainstream media and also entertainment media is trying purposefully to embed this narrative of fear into Americans so that they will continue to vote Democrat. What do conservatives do to challenge those lies?
Well, you have to meet them head on. You have to take them on one by one. And again, you know, I live in Texas, and frankly, I would have predicted that the overturning of Roe versus Wade might create more social upheaval and convulsions than there actually have been. And I say that only because Roe was essentially embedded in law all the way back to 1973. So whenever you have something that's been going on for 50 years and then it changes, it's going to cause some upheaval. I mean, think of the upheaval caused, for example, by the civil rights laws in the 1950s and 1960s. And yet, the level of normalcy in Texas has been incredible to see. Now, this is not to say that women in Texas can't get abortions. You just can't get them in Texas. You've got to go someplace else. But that's the will of the Texas voters. So what we have is democracy in action. I think the problem on the Republican side is that we're not doing a good enough job to lay out the full case against Biden. True, the media is on the other side. But very often there needs to be, I think, a more systematic just pointing out this is what Biden says. This is what the reality is. So I'm not saying none of that is happening, but I don't think enough of that is happening. I think Katie Britt, in her response to Biden, took a very homey kind of homespun type of approach, which was endearing in a way, but not appropriate to the extreme belligerence and partisanship of the Biden address.
I agree. And I was talking in the opening segment about a poll that I posted on my X feed that was split down the line on whether people thought she had a genuine suburban mom type of response versus more of a cringy tradwife vibe, which is what a lot of more seasoned political commentators suggested. But it could have been a stark policy contrast rather than this visual of a mom in the kitchen after you've seen the halls of power in Congress and a president talking about this. So it was a contrast, but I agree with you, Dinesh D'Souza, that it was not exactly the right tone. And it came across a little bit strange, I think, in terms of this is the official Republican response. If she had just posted this video on her own social media and this was one of several responses, maybe that would have been a little more well-received. But this is what she said specifically about IVF, which I found fascinating that the one area that she focused on as a promise to the suburban women that she's talking to is that the GOP as a whole wants to protect IVF specifically. So this is cut eight.
We, the people, are still in the driver's seat. We get to decide whether our future will grow brighter or whether we'll settle for an America in decline. Well, I know which choice our children deserve. And I know the choice the Republican Party is fighting for. We are the party of hardworking parents and families. And we want to give you and your children the opportunities to thrive. And we want families to grow. It's why we strongly support continued nationwide access to in vitro fertilization. We want to help loving moms and dads bring precious life into this world. Wesley and I believe there is no greater blessing in life than our children.
So, Dinesh, that was an interesting, very strong statement. She came across to me, it reminded me a little bit of the older movie Miss Congeniality of you know, the kind of overacted, like, but her delivery aside, what did you make of that specific promise?
Well, you know, I think back to the trying to put these things in a larger context. I think back to the original elements of the Reagan vision for America. And while Reagan is sometimes portrayed as this kind of rugged individualist, Reagan always emphasized that he was running on five things: the individual, the family, the local community, the church, and the country. So ultimately, conservatism isn't just about the individual. It's also about the family. It's about local attachments, little leagues, and so on. And then it's about patriotism and faith. And I think although a great deal has changed over the past since the Reagan era, in some ways, some of Reagan's rhetorical approaches and so on are obsolete now just because our political temperature is completely different. Nevertheless, the elements of the Reagan vision remain in place, and that is the key to the Republican Party, and that is what we believe as conservatives. So I think that the key is to be able to express this in an effective way. Now, Trump has his own, as you know, very distinctive approach. The drugs are wearing off. You know, he's almost trolling Biden. And in some senses, you could say that that's a very unpresidential approach on Trump's part. But on the other hand, it has its own kind of rhetorical effectiveness. The main thing for the Republicans is not to come across as insincere. We need statesmanship. We need solemnity. But we also need some anger on our part. And I also think we need a good measure of ridicule, because sometimes when someone is saying something that's completely preposterous, the emperor has no clothes approach is appropriate.
I couldn't agree more in the sense that sometimes the only thing you can do is just laugh at the absurdity of the leftist position, because if you respond seriously, that's presuming that their position is a serious one that needs to be rebutted with a measure of actual argument. And often we do need to do that, but there are some things that are just so absurd that we can just simply mock them. And President Trump had his pre-buttal, which was, as you mentioned, you know, full of kind of the Trump style rhetoric that is divisive in itself along, you know, what people think of it. But did you watch RFK Jr.'s response? He posted this about 9-minute video that I thought was exceptionally well done, you know, regardless of our conservative policy differences on issues like pro-life, things that are very important. Just the measure of sincerity that he had in contrasting the America that was the Kennedy era, and when we were a shining city on the hill that he alluded to and said, and what is happening now, the contrast that he brought was so clear, and I just thought it was so well done.
Yeah, he's a very intriguing fellow because on certain topics, he is he has a level of depth that you're very surprised to see in a politician. And then on other issues, he seems unbelievably clueless. So, for example, on the affirmative action issue, when I heard him comment, it's almost like he thought he was living in 1954 and that affirmative action was nothing other than, you know, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech translated into policy. And I'm thinking to myself, don't you have any idea of how these policies are actually implemented in the manner that utterly reversed the meaning of the Civil Rights Act? It didn't seem like he did. So at times I'm sort of intrigued and think, wow, this guy has a man of statesman like proportions. At other times, I just scratch my head.
I think that's actually the best analysis that I've heard so far. But that doesn't surprise me, Dinesh, because you are one of the best conservative commentators in breaking down the ideology and what we all need to think about conservatism and our values and our current politics. And I don't say that lightly because there's such an abundance of voices and noise. It's very difficult sometimes to break through and for genuine Christians and conservatives to know who can they trust. And so you have a fairly new film, Police State, and also you're an author and your show. So in just about the last 30 seconds I have with you, where can people find that and follow you?
Well, a good place to start is to check out my podcast. I do it daily, audio and video, and it's available in audio on Apple, Google, and Spotify. It's available in video on Rumble. Just look for the Dinesh D'Souza podcast, and it will pop right up. It's a good way to get my kind of daily take on what's happening in the world, and that'll then lead you to books and movies and so on.
Excellent. Well, Dinesh, thank you so much for joining me this morning, and I really appreciate you and Debbie so much, and your support also for me and everything that I've gone through. That really meant a lot to me, so I just want to publicly thank you so much for that, and we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And that was just really fascinating analysis from Dinesh D'Souza. And I always appreciate conservatives that are, you know, really willing to look at the issues, you know, and notice because he is a very strong Trump supporter that he's willing to say, you know, sometimes the rhetoric gets a little bit too much and it's not, you know, as well. But is, you know, still willing to support President Trump. And so I appreciate people like that, that can have very solid analysis that's not always just having to come from a place of, you know, no matter what, we're always defending the GOP or no matter what, we're always, you know, defending Trump or whoever, you know, the nominee is, because we should be able to, as conservatives, look at things from a genuinely conservative perspective, not just party politics. And I thought his analysis of RFK Jr. Was genuinely the best articulation that I've heard of just what a fascinating candidate he is. And I found myself personally just going back and forth saying, I really love what he has to say on X thing. And then he'll say something else that I'm like, that is so Democrat leftist. No way. Like, yeah, you clearly don't understand the more significant issues here. And, you know, not that I understand absolutely everything, but as a voter, that's the metric. And I can choose to critique that. And yet RFK Jr. posted a response to the State of the Union video last night, and I want to play the full audio. I would encourage you to go on X. It's on, you know, all the social media channels and watch it, because of course there's video and it's almost like this Hollywood style production. So the imagery that he chooses to put, he and his team put behind this, I think is important, but just his message here, regardless of, again, the policy and the very important policy areas that that I disagree with him, that I think conservatives should disagree with, like his position on abortion, for example, that certainly I disagree with. That wasn't anywhere in this. It was just a call back to being proud of America and something like this, but with more of a conservative policy bite to it, would have been something I would have loved to see from the Trump campaign. And I really hope that as the Trump campaign gets further into this general election cycle, that they will do more things in the same vein that really captured the spirit of Americans who want to be proud of our country, who want to stand up and say, yes, I support the flag and I'm not, you know, a racist or a bigot for doing so. I want to say that I love my country. I want to say that, you know, I'm not just living in fear and we're not just so concerned that our nation is now in decline such that we're behind so many other countries. We used to be, you know, the number one envy of the world. And we want to be that again because, though, of conservative values and truth. And so just in the sense of being proud to be an American, listen to this from RFK Jr. and see what you think in terms of what this message and this contrast between the leftist progressive agenda and what he, and I think Dinesh put it well, what he maybe romanticizes about the Kennedy presidency and era. But in a sense, we should be romanticizing America in the sense of we, as Americans, want to continue to create a more perfect union. We want to idealize our values and our government because we want to continue to have genuine progress, not progressiveness, but progress toward perfecting our perfect union in the best way possible. So this is Cut 13, RFK. Listen to this.
I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and I'm running as an independent candidate for President of the United States. I grew up in an America that seemed to have achieved its promise as an exemplary nation. Modern democracy had spread from one nation, ours, in 1776, to six by 1865, and to 190 by the 1960s. We had become the city on the hill. We were a moral authority around the globe. Our government, institutions, our Congress, the court, the regulatory agencies, and even the American press were renowned for their integrity and they were revered worldwide. Other nations wanted our American leadership. They knew the difference between leadership and bullying, which is something our current leaders seem to have forgotten. We were the template of liberty, proof that for a country to thrive, its people must be free. Free to speak, free to worship, free to build great companies, free to start small businesses. We were the freest country in the world, and by no coincidence, also the most prosperous. Working Americans could provide for their families on a single salary. They could buy a home, raise a family, save for retirement without mountains of debt. We made the best music. We made the best movies. We made gold standard automobiles that everybody in the world wanted. We made blue jeans. We reconstructed Europe. We put men on the moon. We have the world's healthiest, best-educated children. Our productivity, ingenuity, our can-do spirit were the envy of the world. We had confidence in our strength, our capacity, and the limitless potential of our country. Yeah, we had serious racial and environmental problems, but in the heady days of my youth, the environmental movement and the civil rights movement were picking up steam. My father and some of his allies were fighting to eliminate the last pockets of hunger in Appalachia and the Mississippi Delta and on the Indian reservations. And we became for the first time a true constitutional democracy in this country with all races voting and holding political office. Other countries aspired to be like us, and our children grew up proud of their passport, proud of their flag. My uncle, President Kennedy, left us a legacy of peace and the hope of ending the arms race and winding down the Cold War. Those were the traditions of freedom, prosperity, and peace that my father, my uncle, and Martin Luther King Jr. were striving to protect and advance. In the half century since their deaths, we've lost touch with that vision for our country. But I want to tell you right now that we can still restore that America, the America that almost was, and yet may be. But we have to start by being honest with ourselves. Neither my uncle nor my father would recognize the version of America that we have today. We become a nation of chronic illness, of violence, of loneliness, depression, and division, and poverty. Our great cities are becoming tent encampments, modern-day Hoovervilles filled with undocumented immigrants and dispossessed Americans and people living in their cars, plagued by mental illness and addiction and despair. Our border has come under the control of criminal drug cartels that traffic in desolation and fentanyl and in busloads of desperate human beings. Our children are drowning in a crisis of alienation, of dispossession, and complete disconnection from their communities. We've lost far more of our young people to drugs in the last decade than in the 20-year Vietnam War. We've printed 9 centuries worth of money in a little over a decade and spent $8 trillion on regime change wars. Those wars have made America less safe, our country less strong, and the world far less stable, while sending prices through the roof as our infrastructure falls apart. Tens of millions of young Americans no longer even dream of owning their own home. What happened to America, the land of opportunity, where you could be sure that if you worked hard and played by the rules, that you would have a decent life? All the new wealth of the last generation has gone to the billionaires and to transnational corporations, while our tattered middle class, our infrastructure, our industry have been hollowed out from the inside. Instead of promise, we've left our kids sick and drowning in debt. The public debt has gone from about $5 trillion under President George W. Bush to $34 trillion today, and U.S. household debt is at a record high of $17.3 trillion. If you include discouraged workers, our true unemployment rate is 23%. Young parents face housing, grocery, and childcare costs that are unaffordable. Too many Americans are living bleak and hopeless lives, dreading the one medical emergency or the car repair that will tip them over the edge into homelessness. We rank 40th globally in our people's health and wellness. Out of the richest countries in the world, the United States is 35th in child poverty rates, just above Mexico. We rank 36th in literacy and 45th in press freedom. We have one of the highest cancer rates in the world, and our life expectancy now ranks 59th, according to the World Bank. That's right behind Algeria, which spends less than 1/30th per capita of what we spend. But even these grim figures hide the full picture of our dire health crisis. We now have the worst health outcomes in the rich world, the highest maternal mortality rates, the highest number of gun deaths per capita, and the highest number of teen pregnancies. We lead the world in obesity and chronic disease. According to CDC, 60% of Americans have at least one chronic condition. When my uncle was president, only 6% of Americans had chronic disease. And all of these plights fall heaviest on our young people. 4 in 10 of them suffer depression, and half of them have considered suicide. 1 in 10 has anxiety. 1 in 10 has ADHD. 1 in 5 is obese. It's time for us to say enough is enough. We were once a free and thriving nation, the healthiest and strongest in the world. What we once were, we can be again. How do I know that? It's because everywhere I go in this country, I see a profound determination among Americans to heal. We might have become the sickest country on earth, but we also have the most ingenious healers, both inside and outside conventional medicine. We may have sky-high levels of depression and addiction, but we also have innovators who have opened up new frontiers in recovery. We have some of the world's most depleted agricultural soils, but also some of the world's most innovative and energetic regenerative farmers. We have serious economic problems, but we also have the brightest and most ambitious entrepreneurs. We face hunger and homelessness, and yet we meet it with the highest philanthropic rates in the world and bottomless kindness and compassion. We may be on the mat today, but we can be on our feet and happy and healthy and strong again with good leadership tomorrow. Our people and our system were built for resilience. And here's the most important thing I want to tell you about the state of our union. Our nation seems more divided than ever, but Americans everywhere want to heal that divide. Our nation has become artificially divided by political forces that can survive only when we, the people, are at war with each other. People are tired of being manipulated by fear. We learned that lesson during COVID. We recognize that the same techniques of manipulating fear are being used by elites today to corral us into voting for one political candidate or the other. Americans are tired of these dire warnings that to preserve democracy itself, you better vote for our guy. I can tell you that in every state of this union, people are rejecting fear-mongering. 80% of Americans say they don't want to be forced to choose in this election between the lesser of two evils. They're tired of voting against something or someone. I see it in the crowds of mixed Republicans and Democrats and independents who attend my rallies that a growing number of Americans are rejecting divisiveness. They're ready to unite, to rebuild this country, and to fulfill the promise of the America of my youth. They're ready to vote for something and for someone they like, for someone who represents hope and healing, or someone with a inspiring vision for America's future, for a future that they can believe in. So that's the State of the Union that I want to bring you today. It's a nation that hungers to heal. It's a nation ready to face reality, to rebuild, to end the forever foreign wars, to clean out the corrupt Washington establishment, and to turn again toward peace, freedom, good health, and prosperity. When we unite in that vision, we're going to be unstoppable. Thank you, and God bless you.
Some really powerful stuff there from RFK Jr. And the only thing very, very obviously missing was turning back to God. That's the only way that America will see that kind of innovation, prosperity, and correct direction. And as I was listening to that, you know, again just now, so that's probably about the third or fourth time I've listened to that since it was posted last night. I think that was such a powerful message in terms of the contrast of the trajectory of America. And it reminds me of, you know, where we're at today. And it reminds me of a piece that I was trying to find. And if I find it, I'll mention it on Monday and also post it on my social media from Jeremy Boring, who is the CEO of Daily Wire. He wrote a piece several years ago that was talking about why America is so great and how we are innovators and creators because work and being creators are part of the image of God, our creator. And it was such a wonderful piece that just laid this out so beautifully. And I hope I can find it again. But that type of message that is encouraging and saying we've got to get back on track here rather than just the political two-party mudslinging at each other is a message, I think, of hope overall and of saying we need to, as Americans, not just as, you know, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, come together to actually identify the problem. And the reason that we can't, though, is because Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals fundamentally disagree on the purpose of government and even more fundamentally, the purpose of man. And if RFK Jr. could add one very, very important ingredient, it would be the analysis of why we are here. The purpose of man ultimately is to come into a saving knowledge of Christ and to know and worship God, our creator. And when we start fundamentally with the principles that God gives us our rights, he is our identity, then we will innovate. We will use our resources for the glory of God. We will understand why family is important, why church should be the epicenter of civil society, why we should have truth in society and our body politic. The only hope for this nation is to turn back to God, to repent for our sin, turn back to God, and not community guilt, corporate guilt, but individually. Repent, turn back to God, and encourage this nation to once again say that we are one nation under God. Have a great weekend. You can always reach me, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.